This is Annie Reynolds. I'm here with James Powell on October 18th, 2024. We're in the Hudson Area Library History Room for an oral history as part of the Hudson Area Library Oral History Project.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi, Annie. How are you?
I'm very well today. I'm really happy to be here with you for this interview.
I'm happy too. I'm really happy. I was a bit nervous, but I'm happy.
Fantastic. Very happy. Well, could we start? I would love it if you would introduce yourself.
Yes. My name is James Powell, and I live in Hudson, New York, in the center of town. I think I live like right in the center of town, in my opinion. That could be wrong. On the 400 block in Warren Street. And I'm gonna break the rules probably because I'm like, how far? What do you wanna know? How should I introduce myself? I guess I've been trained to do this properly by being in the Oral History Summer School Project, so I could tell you like where I'm from and all those things. I was born, and I think this is really important to say, I'm from the American South, meaning the South in the United States. And I say that because I think it's really informed who I am culturally, and also why I'm so interested in the arts and cultures as a method of messaging and storytelling. So I was born in El Paso, Texas. The reason why I landed, my parents landed there, is my father was in the medic unit of the military at the time. And 3 months after I was born, they decided to go back to their hometown. They were gonna send my father overseas, and my mother was not in health condition wise to actually travel overseas. So my dad decided to leave the military, and with that moved my older sister and I back to their hometown in Low Country, South Carolina. And Low Country, South Carolina is one of the most beautiful places, I think, personally, in the world. It is a place where there's a creolization of culture. It is known for the Gullah Islands, the Geechee culture that's there, which sort of is a mixture of, I would say, in a modern day context of the Caribbean culture that we know today, African culture directly from the West African continent, fused with obviously the European colonial history that brought us here, which is a very complicated and nuanced story. But that all forms the Lowcountry, which also has a very particular climate that is different from the rest of South Carolina. It's tropical in a way, maybe semi-tropical is the correct term. You'll see a lot of palmetto trees. You see countryside meet beach. So think of Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust, which was filmed on St. Helena Island. Think The Big Chill, which was filmed across the bridge from Beaufort in Hilton Head. And even Forrest Gump, that was also filmed in Beaufort, and The Prince of Tides. I could just go on and on about all the movies that were filmed there. But also thinking of the people who were Gullah, who many of them lived off of these islands off the coast of South Carolina and northern Georgia. One that I can call to mind is Defusky Island. And these people who were formerly enslaved people escaped and took different methods to get to these islands, and they preserved a history. They lived on these islands without electricity, but they were free, and they created their own culture that was not a part of mainstream culture, which is what Daughters of the Dust really talks about. So it's a great movie that sort of goes into that. Also think there's part of Georgia that's a part of the country. Savannah is probably the most well-known town in Georgia that embodies that culture. So if you think of the Midnight The Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. That was a book that was made into a movie about the murder of this gay antique dealer. But there's a cast of colorful characters that come out of that book and that were on the film, such as the Lady Chablis, who was a trans drag performer in Savannah, who died, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago. Black woman, completely stole the narrative. She was incredible, and her spirit was indomitable. And it's just a beautiful place to be from. It has a complicated history. I mean, the state of South Carolina was one of the port of Charleston in particular was one of the most busiest ports when it came to bringing in enslaved people. I've heard on one podcast that as Vegas has a gambling problem, South Carolina and Charleston in particular had a slave trading problem. And so with that, the majority of people of African descent who were brought here by the slave trade came in not only through New Orleans, the ones that settled in the United States, but also a lot of folks, regardless of where they went in the States, they came through the Port of Charleston. So many people can actually trace, especially Black folks, can trace their histories back to South Carolina. It's one of the places in the South where you can find that. I ended up moving when I was 9 years old from Columbia, South Carolina to Richmond, Virginia, which is another southern state. There are some similarities between South Carolina and Virginia, but Virginia, I would say, is Richmond in particular was the capital of the Confederacy. It was the last capital of the Confederacy. And it represented in many ways the New South, because they didn't pick it not only because of its geographic location, but also because it was one of the few southern cities that was really moving towards industrialization, which is where our country was, which is one of the reasons why we were, you know, in the Civil War, was not only about slavery. It all came back to the enslavement of people, and I don't want to make that small because that was a very big part of it. But I don't think, unfortunately, people were not morally like, oh God, you know, we're doing something that's wrong. It really had a lot to do with the economy and how the United States was being viewed as a world power. We were one of the few major world powers or growing world powers that still was enslaving people openly. And that looked bad. And also economically, we were shifting from a more agricultural sort of agrarian society to one that was looking at industrialization. And so Richmond represented that, and it had a great deal of wealth. And it's also, Virginia's the home of the first settlement that brought in the first enslaved people in 1619, which there's been a lot of information about that most recently. At the time when I moved to Richmond, we're talking the early 90s when L. Douglas Wilder was the first African-American governor in the United States, which is very hard to believe. He was governor, and then after he was governor, he went back because he wasn't finished yet and became mayor of Richmond. So he did it in reverse. But I say that because my parents decided to move there not only because of job opportunities, but they had read in a magazine that Richmond had a very strong Black professional class that was involved in city politics, in state politics, and really had a great deal of agency. So I say that when we lived in Richmond, for me, it was kind of the golden age of Black culture, you know, in film, in music. I mean, I can go on and on about the variety of people who were just big names at the time, you know, all the boy groups, Boyz II Men, you know, Luther Vandross, Whitney Houston was still belting out beautiful, you know, ballads, and my childhood was filled with movies. You know, before Halle Berry won an Oscar, I knew her through the movie Boomerang with what's his name? Oh, God. Eddie Murphy and Robin Givens. And there was a certain innocence because this was before social media and also people having mobile devices, you know, unless you were just, you know, pretty much very, you know, wealthy or, you know, you needed to have, if you were a doctor and you needed a pager, you know, you were, you know, we still relied on the house phone. And so there was an intimacy that still existed. Kids were still going outside in addition to playing video games. You know, it was before AOL was really big, at least in my community. I can only speak on that. But it was a beautiful time. It was also a time that I didn't realize, even though I had a father that worked in medicine, I did not understand that it was also a time that we were in the middle of the AIDS crisis. I mean, it wasn't obviously like it was during the beginning of the pandemic. It was, you know, we were trying to move over to getting medication, but I did watch And the Band Played On. I did not understand it to its full, to what it really was getting to. Now I understand it a lot. But there were people that were dying and were very sick and did not have access. And there was a grave stigma attached to having HIV and AIDS. I think about the fact that Marlon Riggs and Essex Hemphill died, you know, in the mid 90s. And I did not have a clue as to who they were. You know, I might have seen images of them. And I pride myself growing up in a household that was very culturally, you know, my parents loved the arts. My dad loved music. He still loves music. My mother, they were just little black hippies, you know, and also militants in a way. So I did pride myself on that. But while that was happening, I kind of felt a little shielded from what was happening with the AIDS crisis. And I'm sure people were dying in Richmond, but, you know, I was just sort of like a lot of other kids, we just did not see it, or at least our parents kind of hid it from us. Later on, I learned that my dad saw people dying in the hospital, especially that were gay. And I think that kind of informed him of how he was able to, what scared him about my queer identity initially, you know, was what he had seen during the crisis. But there was a lot of things going on. Arthur Ashe died when I lived in Richmond. And so, you know, famous tennis player, to say the least, that's an understatement. He was an advocate. He was incredible. And he died of AIDS through a blood transfusion. And I remember being in the fourth grade and going to a predominantly black school, Southampton Model School, and how it was so powerful that they suspended classes that day. And if you did not attend the services, you were in your class watching the funeral. And, you know, when I think back at that and how powerful that was, it also was the time where President Clinton, you know, the Clintons were rising to their helm at the and their political dynasty of the Democratic Party. And I became infatuated at 9 years old with now Secretary Clinton. I thought she was one of the most polarizing first ladies that we ever had. And I don't know if it was the blonde hair. I don't know if it was the transformation into being this, you know, this much more fashionable person. I like to think I loved her because of her politics and how she defined this role of being first lady. And we hadn't seen one as active since Rosalind Carter and Eleanor Roosevelt. I know that's why my parents loved her. And they felt like they got a 2-for-1, you know, package deal. And I remember I cut out all the clippings about the inauguration. I just became obsessed. Like, I was like, I'm going to become a politician, which I did not end up. I went into politics for a very, very short period. But the South to me is, it's, I tell people who come to visit this country that you must go to the South, because so many things that we consider to be American, jazz music, the arts, you know, both visual and performing. You know, I think about Alvin Ailey, there's an exhibit up right now at the Whitney that was curated by Adrian Edwards. All of that Southern experience and that Southern influence that he had. Many of the artists who even migrated up to the North, parts of my family that migrated to Philadelphia in the Midwest, those Southern influences stand strong. And so, I mean, Beyonce from Houston, you know, Solange from Houston. You just think of so many powerhouses that are from the South. And it gets stereotyped as this place where people are slow. Or we want to put all of the racism and all of the homophobia and the Islamophobia in the South, whereas that was part of my experience, but that wasn't the totality of it. I think that people, the thing I loved about growing up in Virginia is that people, in a way, the neighborhood I grew up in was a flight community. So we moved out to the county when I was, after a year of living in the city. And flight communities are communities that were formed as a reaction to the desegregation of public schools. And my school district, or my area that I lived in, was a part of that. And so it was predominantly white. But as Black folks started to move out to the county, the white people who did not want to live in these neighborhoods amongst Blacks because they felt their property value would be lower, they would be more exposed to crime, they just built out even further in the county. But at a time, there was this sort of, this point where you had, you know, the neighborhoods were pretty split as far as their demographic. And you had to live, you know, my neighbors were staunch Republicans. They voted for the Bushes and the Reagans. One of them taught at the school that I was at. They supported people like Oliver North. But when my parents went out of town, they also were people who they were not calling the cops or anything, like if they noticed anything suspicious, but they literally were people that I could go to if I was in trouble or if something happened at the house while they were gone. We had a relationship that was outside of politics, and it was just about being a human being. And I don't want to overly romanticize it, but it did exist at some point. And hopefully those people haven't become too a right-wing conservative. Hopefully they came over to our side, not saying which one is right or wrong. After working in politics, everybody's kind of crazy. But I think it was good to know. I think people were a little bit more upfront about their prejudice because, you know, the South has a history of having to be in racially mixed environments. So when I bring it up to New York, which I'll fast forward to a little bit, is I graduated from Hampton University, which was a historically Black college, or is a historically Black private college. It was founded in 1868 by a former Union General, Samuel Armstrong, who's a Brigadier General, I believe, whatever that means. And he founded this school to educate both freed Blacks, because there were Black people who were freed pre-Civil War, as well as recently freed enslaved people. And there was a two-year program, which was more about trade and farming. And then there was there was a 4-year sort of classical liberal arts track, and now there's just one track. We also had an Indigenous assimilationist program at our school, which I'm not necessarily proud of, but the interesting thing about that is the students of African descent were teaching the Indigenous students on civics and how to be a good citizen in the United States, which is ridiculous. So the school has a lot of history. One of the alum is Booker T. Washington. I can go on and on about my experience at Hampton, but it is what, you know, really got me. I had a friend who was studying abroad at Barcelona, and she came back for the second semester of our senior year to graduate, and she said, you know what, you should do this program with Bloomingdale's, and it's this buyer trainee program, and you can be a junior executive, and they select 16 people to be in this program. And I was like, okay, I don't want to go to law school, and I don't want to go get my master's in public policy, and I don't want to go into politics. Although I had been offered jobs in that area, and I was supposed to go to DC and all that stuff. She convinced me to apply for this program. I did. I got 2 interviews. I got rejected at first, but I was at the top of the waiting list, and they said, you know, no one ever gets taken off this waiting list because this is one of the most competitive programs. So, and then after they told me that, the next day they called me and said, this never happened. Someone dropped out. Do you want to come to New York? That salary was so ridiculously low. I didn't negotiate at all. I just wanted to go to New York City so bad that I took the job. I didn't have a place to live until maybe a week before I was going to move there, because my parents had to intervene to their chagrin because they didn't really want me to go. I know they kind of wanted me to like stay and go to DC and do something that was a little bit, they felt like a little bit more on cue with what I had been studying for, or just what they thought I would be best at. And so I ended up staying with a cousin of mine, and this is our family who had migrated to New York, for the first, I guess, I stayed with a couple, my friend's family. She had married an Etrian man. And I say that because I stayed in Harlem for 2 weeks, and his aunt, Tanti, I think is what they call aunt, she was visiting from Cairo. She was only supposed to stay for like a week or two. She ended up staying for months. And I was sleeping in the guest bedroom, but obviously she's an elder. They were a newlywed couple. I had to go shift out to the living room and the bed. But because in Etrian culture or this part of Africa, people stay up very late. And they were trying to adjust to it. But because she was African-American, and she was like, yeah, they're going to start having dinner at like 9 or 10 o'clock. And I would be up until 1 in the morning having to get to Midtown for work. So eventually, she was like, I'm trying to have kids. We can't have babies as newlyweds with having dinners this late with everyone coming over the house. I love you, but you're going to have to find someone else to stay. So I ended up staying with my cousin in Westchester, which I was grateful for, but it was such a horrible commute. But eventually I found an apartment in Harlem, and that began my time in New York City as a queer Black man. And I think it's so funny that my mom and dad dropped me off in New York City during Pride Week. that was my introduction to the city.
And what year are we talking here?
2005, June 2005. Which seemed like yesterday. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. So for the longest time, well, not for the longest time, but for the first few months up until September, I didn't get an apartment. I ended up getting an apartment in Harlem, literally two, like a block around, like I was on Madison, And my friend's sister was on 119th and Park or something. And so we ended up getting an apartment. I found an apartment literally by walking around Harlem at night and seeing a for rent sign by owner. And I don't think you can really do that anymore. But at the time, I did. We got the apartment, and the rest is history. But I was so excited about moving to New York City, mainly because I knew I was going to be able to discover my queer identity. And that was important to me. But at the time, I thought that, okay, I'm just going to go and have relationships with different men and possibly fall in love, possibly not. You know, by that point, I had had a few little, you know, flings in college, but nothing serious, all very on the down low and undercover. And so I was like, I'm just going to get it out of my system. And then I'm going to get married to a woman and have kids. And it'll be fine because that's the road I'm going down. I went on one outing to a gay club and I was like, yeah, that plan is trash. So I was not going to be doing that. But I remember, you know, this was not a time where smartphones, I don't even know if there were smartphones, but if they were, I didn't have access to them because I could not afford a smartphone. Probably were like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in 2005. And so what I did one day was I went to the Gap after work. And I changed out of my business attire and I bought like flip-flops of all things because this is the summer and some like khaki pants and a shirt. And I asked for the biggest bag possible and I put my suit and everything in that bag. And I remember leaving East Midtown. This was probably like 55th Street or 53rd Street, I think, in Lexington. No, 53rd and 3rd was where my office was because I was always late. And I remember taking it on Friday and just walking until I found Christopher Street. It was just like something magical led me there. I don't know. I just was like, I'm going to walk until I find something gay. And I found it. And it was one of the most magical things because it was like the first time your parents let you stay home by yourself. I never felt that free because there was no one watching me. I didn't know anybody. And I didn't have to hide. I didn't have to be somebody that I wasn't. I stuck out like a sore thumb because I have this big blue and white Gap bag. And like this is probably horribly like awful outfit. Like, I look extremely provincial and I'm in this, you know, much more cosmopolitan, you know, city. And I'm just like, hey, my name is Becky Sue, you know, like I kind of felt like that. And I remember the first club I went into was Stonewall, which is where the riots happened in the 1960s. And I met this wonderful guy, and it was just interesting. Just being in New York was just really, really interesting. And I could go on and on about that, but I want to talk about, you know, Hudson and like how I came here. And I give you the origin, like a very brief overview of my origins, because I do think that who we were as children, I'm starting to find more and more, is that we live with that person. We live with that child's fears, that child's traumas, the things that trigger us, the things that make us happy, the things that make us most comfortable are really defined when we were kids. And so my childhood was spent in that. And I think I've had various childhoods. I've had the sort of traditional human childhood, and then I've had my gay childhood, which was spent primarily in New York. That was my coming of age for my queerness. But what led me to Hudson was living in New York City. And I had a roommate who is to this day one of my best friends. His name is Prentice Anderson. And he was the fashion director, our editor, for a magazine called The 10th Magazine. And The 10th Magazine is a publication, also an independent queer media company that was founded by Kyrie Seth, Kyle Banks, and Andre Jones. And Andre and Kyle are from Louisiana, and Kyrie is from Queens, New York. And grew up in Long Island, I think. Anyway, this is not their interview, so I don't need to tell all their stories. But they founded this wonderful publication, and one of the best. And it explored the African diaspora through an LGBTQ lens. And so there was a thematic, there was a theme for every issue. You know, one was the industrialists meet the dreamers. So that was about the LA meeting sort of the Midwest, in industry, long gone industries of the Midwest, in like Detroit and parts of Missouri. So they went out to Detroit. And then there was the technology issue, which was the issue that I came on to in 2016. And then there was the issue that we did here, that was born out of our experiences in Hudson, which was romanticism through a Black queer lens. But when I worked at the Clinton Foundation for 6 years, and then I ended up deciding to go more into freelancing, I worked unsuccessfully at Artsy and the Aspen Institute, and I came, you know, trying to go back to my Clinton roots. But then I realized, like, I want to go into the arts. I want to do it full time. I do not belong in a corporate environment. I can work with corporations, but I don't need to be there. So I ended up working. My friend who I was living with in Harlem, he says, there's this publication you should know about. And I would watch him, and he would go away for like 3 weeks or several months. And he was like, yeah, we're going on our road trip for the magazine. And I was like, what? You know, what are you doing? Because he was a fashion stylist. That was his full-time job. I was like, what are you doing working with this magazine? Like, what is it about? And he would call me from the road and say, you know, we almost got shot at because we were doing these, you know, shooting a model, our story in the middle of the deep South in a neighborhood we had no business in, or we were in California in LA and we were wearing the wrong colors and we tried to put this model on a car and we didn't know whose car it belonged to. And someone told us that this belonged to a gang and like we needed to be careful about, you know, where we shot at, and but we got you, you know, the person would say, we got you. And so I'm just like, what in the heck are you doing? This is so fascinating. And we'd come home and he would give me a little bit of information. And then finally he was like, look, if you want to know more about this, come to the launch party. So they launched officially, I believe it was in 2014, down on the Lower East Side. And I just fell in love with what I was seeing, because so many times, I think in underrepresented communities, and I say this, I've been saying this a lot more recently, is that I think sometimes we, and I see this a lot in gay culture, is like, we want to fit into these heteronormative constructs. We want to fit into respectability politics to make ourselves a lot more digestible to a mainstream audience, which will then give us more visibility. And with more visibility, maybe it will give us more funding and support to put our message out there. But in the process of this mainstreaming, which I go back to also, you know, thinking about the indigenous people who we were teaching how to mainstream at Hampton, you lose something. You lose life, you lose narrative. It's a colonization of a culture. And some people can lose a lot more than others. But I think, you know, it's an issue and it still exists today. But one thing I say that about the 10th is they were just extremely smart but gritty at the same time. They wanted to not only be in Barnes & Noble, they wanted to be in independent news stores, they wanted to be in bodegas and newsstands, which they were, but they also were in the Library of Congress, and they did not want to clean up stories to make them more digestible for the public. So they were very radical in that mission. And so for the first time, I saw myself, because I had been the respectability politics guy, you know, with the, as Kyrie would always say, the hard-toe-shoed Harlem, you know, gentleman. I was that person, you know, that was going to church every day, every Sunday, and, you know, making sure that I was doing what I thought was the right thing to do and to fit in and whatever. But that never fed me. And I always kind of was a rebel in my own right. And so when I saw this publication and what they were doing, I was like, I want to be a part of this. This is beautiful. This is new. This is needed. This is intellectual. This is stimulating. This is making a change. And so I ended up writing a couple of things for them. We did a partnership with the Leslie Lohman Museum. And Kyrie was gracious enough one day to invite me to come onto the road trip that I had been hearing about. It's these famous road trips where they'd be like sardines in a car going from LA to San Francisco, which is what we did for hours. And, you know, we're, you know, listening to music and smoking a joint and doing all the things. But he invited me for the technology issue. It was going to be two issues, technology and culture. And this is, again, in 2016 in the spring. So this was pre-Donald Trump and, like, right before. So I'm on a flight in, I think it was May-ish or March. I can't remember. It was spring. I go to Oakland, and I'm with a photographer from Philadelphia, queer photographer and dancer, choreographer Marcus Branch, a gentleman by the name of, it was me, Marcus, and Kyrie. And we land at Fruitvale. We're at Fruitvale, which there was that movie, Fruitvale Station, with Michael B. Jordan, that was big at the time based on the real events. And we got to interview all these incredible people, Black queer people in Oakland and in San Francisco. I mean, you're talking about guy Brian Freeman from the Poma Homos and Kelly Love Monster, who had this iconic party series that just brought out every Black punk person in Oakland in the Bay Area, and ended up moving to Australia, where he is now with his partner and child. We got to meet the brilliant writer and Brontez Purnell, who on the first night we went out, he asked me if I wanted to have a threesome with his then boyfriend, and they go on to tell me what their HIV status is, and I politely was like, I would, but I had, you know, I have to get up early in the morning. So it was a crash course, because I had never been on a road trip. And from this, I ended up, you know, we would bring in writers and artists and people at different stages of the trip. And because I was one of the producers with helping with the logistics at the time, they were gracious enough to let me stay the entire trip, you know, and we were there for at least a month, maybe more, just going all over California to San Diego, you know, driving through the deserts. I mean, it was just a life-changing opportunity for me. And one of the people we interviewed was BlackBerry, and BlackBerry was a Black queer folk singer who did some of the soundscapes of Looking for Langston. He just recently passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. And I always tell the story, you know, when we would go to interview people, we'd go interview them in the places that they felt most comfortable. So that was usually at their home or their studio. Some places were a little weirder than others, and I love weird. But with Blackberry, we went to his home in Oakland, and I said, well, what would you like us to bring you? And he said, I want you to bring me a burrito, and it's got to be made this way, and I want a margarita, and I want some joints. And we brought him all of those things, and he was like, you have to partake with me. And so I'm like, okay, cool. So for 3 hours, we got this incredible interview about his life. I cried, we laughed, we did everything. And those were the moments that I remember the most, you know? We also went to Portland. We drove to Portland. I got to see my friend who was doing his last bout of chemotherapy. He was a professor in San Francisco at the time. He ended up joining us for a portion of the trip, Dr. Nathan Alexander. We just had a ball. And so I went back home saying that I have to do this for the rest of my life. I cannot go back to anything else. And Kyrie was someone that I really looked up to. I mean, and I still do, even though we don't work together and I barely ever see him. He is one of the smartest people I know. And you know how you have times in your life where there are people that just sort of rise, you know, you just sort of, there are points in your life, there's that teacher, like that, like I had an English teacher named Mrs. Biddle in 11th grade, who I got the lowest grade in English from. Internet IB English, you know, advanced English, British literature. But I learned the most from her. Like she was just, I mean, we read Beowulf and I learned about the themes of lightness and darkness. And we talked about the four stages of madness for Hamlet. And we went to the Folgers Theater and saw them played by four different women. And I mean, she wrote my letter of recommendation for a couple of things. And this woman was just brilliant. She's the reason why I know how to write the way I write today. Not to say I couldn't write before, but she lifted a bar for all of us. And I would say Kyrie, not that I wasn't already a deep thinker, but when it came to my eye for things and to seeing how the past connects with the future and how we open that up to a multicultural, but really multi-generational Black queer audience, was something that it really helped me. And I, to this day, anything that I do, I really give him a lot of credit for that. He's brilliant, and I can't wait to see more of what he writes and all the things he's done. At least I hope he like writes an incredible book or something. Anyway, saying that, all to say is we worked together, and he was crazy enough to, or thought that I was, had enough charity to bring me along on a lot of things I was doing, and we went, after Trump was elected, things changed a lot. When I was living in Harlem, I remember when that day happened. And God, you know, not to be political, but people were really hurt. We were scared. And there wasn't a great sense of direction as to where this country was going. I remember that night I went to an Italian restaurant in Harlem and I ordered takeout. I was gonna eat it and take it out to go. And then I decided, let me just eat it here because things were starting to get change. You know, I thought Hillary Clinton was gonna win. And I had kava, and I had bought a bottle of kava to celebrate. Maybe I should have bought champagne and she would have won, but when things shifted, I took the bottle of kava and I went to a sports bar and I switched over to gin. And I was like, oh God, we're about to lose. And a lot was happening personally in my life. I had to leave my apartment abruptly, and my roommate who I was subleasing for, he had to move to he was moving, he was getting ready to leave the city. And so I was like, what am I going to do? And so I was living with a friend for several months and in Sugar Hill. And so when this all happened, and I remember, you know, everything was just happening. And I remember my friend, when she lost, my friend was in Geneva, and she's from Maryland, and we've known each other for 20 years. And I remember calling her and letting her know, she's 6 hours ahead, that, you know, sorry, what happened. And I said, I'm going to drink this bottle of kava at 2 in the morning. I'm already drunk. And we lamented together. And I tell you that story because I want to really paint a picture of the uncertainty, especially for queer people at that time. I believed that America could get to this point, but I still didn't believe that it could get to this point. I was disappointed. I was scared. I felt guilty thinking about my parents who had protested, you know, who had desegregated schools. For all the people who had done so much work to see it kind of changing overnight. So I felt a need to start living a life that matched the energy of what was going on. So that meant no more playing by the rules. And so committing myself even more to working with the 10th and the magazine was like, all right, I'm going to do this. So in December of that year, we opened the tech issue at MoMA PS1. And then the following year, after going on vacation with my parents for my mom's birthday and thinking about it, I came back to New York with a mission, and we had a pop-up studio in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And while we were there, we started to really think about, okay, what's the next iteration of this magazine gonna look like? And that's when Hudson came up on the radar. Kyrie was like, well, why don't we do like a writer's retreat and go upstate and spend a couple of weeks there? And I was like, sure. I had always loved the history of the Hudson River Valley. Because when I was a kid, my way of meditating, one way that I meditated was to look at landscape paintings. And even the ones that were not, like, my aunt had these landscape paintings of the violent sea hitting the rocks, and I would just stare at them as a kid. And so then as I got older, I became even more obsessed with pastoral, you know, bucolic landscapes. And I would dream about coming upstate to New York and getting married in a barn or on a trade, which became a trend in the city. And I was like, oh, someone's always still in my dream. Like Kim Kardashian, when she like knew her wedding, she was gonna have her wedding picked out, and her sister ends up getting married before her. I think it was Chloe or Courtney, I can't remember. She's like, well, they can have my wedding plans. And this is really stupid that I'm saying this, but anyway, this is like awful. You should probably erase that. But I was like, yeah, upstate, let's do it. Let's go. And so Kyrie rented, we ended up renting a place from a woman named Sarah Van Buren. And she had a house in Stoutville. I think she still has that house. And I came up on the train before Kyrie got here. And he was like, I'll be there any minute or in a few hours, so make yourself at home. I did. I went to ShopRite, which was on Warren Street, but it was near where the Fairview Wines was. It's kind of tucked away. It was a lot smaller. And I remember being so happy being in like a suburban supermarket, because it reminded me of being at home. And I just spent like a good hour and a half going up and down the aisles, like buying the most ridiculous stuff. I even found incense and like Palo Santo, or, you know, I was like, who has this in the supermarket? So went, and I was just I was basking in the light, in the air. And Kyrie ended up eventually coming that evening, and we had a lovely dinner, and Marcus came, and we, you know, Sarah had sent us an email and introduced us to people here in town that she said, you know, reach out to these people, because we were looking for people to interview. And she was away at a music festival in the United Kingdom, in the UK. I don't remember what part of it. It wasn't London. It was like Manchester or something like that. And we ended up meeting people like Shanika McIntosh, and we met Jonathan from Kasori, and I remember interviewing Shanika at the Spotty Dog, and it's so crazy because now she's one of my closest friends here. And when she first met me, I was like, oh my gosh, she hates me. And I think now that I remember it, it was just because she was like, who are these people? And what are they doing? And are they going to just be like these lame ass New Yorkers who come and hang out, and, you know, they came upstate, picked an apple, you know, picked some flowers, went back, talked about it. Now they're going to get an Airbnb. Like, and so, you know, that night when we met Shanika, I remember we went to the Red Dot, and we got in this debate about Susan B. Anthony. It was ridiculous. And about Hillary Clinton and feminism and womanism. And we got in this debate, and I think I said something and made her cry, and then I probably started crying. But then we made up over martinis, and everyone left us, and we were just there. And I was just like, oh my God, these people are gonna think we're crazy and never gonna invite us back to Red Dot. And then the owner the next day, she said to me, I'm so glad you all were here, because this reminds me of how Hudson used to be, you know, loud and people just having debates and crying and laughing. And I was like, oh, if this is the place that, if you like this, then I've found home. And I also met in Spotty Dog my now also dear friend Corinna Rip Shaming, who is the curator and director at UAlbany Museum. And she was very like, you all need to move here. And I was like, well, you're telling me that in a bookstore that has beer and wine. So, you know, not, and I don't want to make it seem like I'm, drinking all the time, but it was nice to have that combination. And it was something magical that happened there. And I remember Kyrie had to leave early, and he left earlier than me, like a few hours that morning. And so I ended up staying, I think, almost an extra day. And I remember when we were visiting, I ended up losing my card and my phone, because there was a moment where I was rolling around in the grass when someone was photographing me. And that's just how happy I was being here. And I lost my phone and my card. I was like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that happened in the world. How am I going to get to the train station? And I ended up having to like use the phone on Google to call a ride to get to the train station. It was so ridiculous. But in that process, instead of freaking out, I kind of slowed down, because I was in the Hudson River Valley, and I was able to work out the problem. It was so easy. And how could you not, in the surroundings you were in? And while I was doing that, I was listening to this song by Mabel Mercer called Use Your Imagination. Mabel Mercer, who was a black cabaret singer, Afro-British, I believe. And she was singing Cole Porter. And I absolutely love Cole Porter. As complicated of a person as he was, as we all are. And I remember looking her up and finding out that Mabel Mercer was queer, and she had a farmhouse, I think in East Chatham. And I was like, what? She was up here? She had been in this affair with the oil heiress. And then Jonathan put us on to a guy who named Bob Cole, who was business and creative partners with James Roseman Johnson, who was the brother of James Weldon Johnson, who wrote the National Negro Anthem, Lift Up Your Voice and Sing. Bob Cole stayed at the English House, which was a black bread and breakfast in Catskill, not far from the Thomas Cole House that Jonathan had bought, and he's recently sold, unfortunately, but the story still lives on. We had met RB and Adam, who had Tiger House at the time, this beautiful, you know, mansion that they had turned into this inn, and they were queer, so all these writers were coming up. And also at the heart of the Hudson River School, which, as you might know, was, really illustrated that literary and arts movement of American Romanticism, because Romanticism originated in Germany and Europe, and then it had many iterations. Well, let me stop. I don't know if it originated in Germany. It originated in Europe, and it had many iterations. So Germany, Italy, France, and then there was American, which kind of was, I guess, mid-19th century, so mid-1800s. And so one of the well-known painters of the Hudson River School, which a lot of folks did not know and still don't know, even though he's getting more praise, was Robert Duncanson. Robert S. Duncanson, who was an African-American man who was born in New York, not in the Hudson River Valley, but was one of the people of, I think, the second movement of the Hudson River School, and was one of the most, if not most talented of the painters, but spent most of his time painting the Ohio River Valley, but was still considered a part of the Hudson River Valley School. He did not get the same amount of money that someone like a Friedrich Church did. And he died. He was kind of a tragic end. I don't think he ever got married or had children. So his legacy died with him, essentially. But it has been getting a research. It's coming back. And in fact, I believe that there was a gift of Landscape on Rainbow, which is one of my Rainbow on Landscape is one of my favorite paintings. Was given to the current Vice President Kamala Harris as a gift. So this all was happening, and the rainbow was just something that we had been studying about even before we came upstate. We had been following Duncanson, and everywhere we went, there was a rainbow after we had been talking about Duncanson. And so that day, there was a rainbow. And I was like, oh, we need to be here. The rainbow has followed us here. And let me just give you a little backdrop by that story, sorry. Because the rainbow, it wasn't just about Duncanson, it was also about Pulse. When we were in Portland driving to, doing a shoot, and I was driving, and it was pouring down, raining, and there was this river, this powerful, we were near Multnomah Falls, and there was this beautiful river, and then there's like what seems to be this prehistoric mountainous like landscape on the other side of me. So I'm freaking out, because nature, I love it, but I fear it at the same time, and its power and its uncertainty. And they say scientifically you can't go through a rainbow, but we did that day. We absolutely drove to the end of whatever part of the rainbow, and it was me, Kyrie, Prentice, and Marcus, and we just felt it. We all started screaming like, oh my God, And I don't think we were the same people, but right after that, Pulse happened, or it had happened, it was around that time. I think it might have been, it had happened the day before, and the aftermath was you know, names were being released about who had died. And one of my best friends, who's like a sister to me, who I've known for 20 years, her cousin was killed. And she called me right after to tell me that. And after we had drove through the rain, like literally, we pulled aside and she said, you know, my cousin died. She got shot. She was killed. And I felt like, being a very spiritual person, that moment of us all being together and us being caught in this moment of almost being transported to another place spiritually, but also feeling innocent and whimsical, how it can be taken away from you so quickly. And I think that was another sign for me to dive deeper into the space. And it makes me a little emotional thinking about it, because I think as queer people and as Black people, I've always been a little afraid of when things go too well, or when I'm allowed to let go and be free and fully express myself and show up. Because I'm always like, where is the other shoe going to fall? And that's just something I've lived with for my whole life. And I think that so many people around this globe right now, as much as we want to celebrate, it is like, when is that other shoe going to fall? Like, you can't be happy for too long to protect yourself from the disappointment and almost to survive. When I'm having this happy time, you know, on the other coast of the U.S., this thing happens in Florida that completely sort of reminds me you can't have too much fun. So I always look for that rainbow after the rain, because it tells me to keep going. And I look at that rainbow even now, you know? And so it's something beyond sort of this, you know, putting a rainbow flag out and saying something safe. It was bigger to me than that. And how that's sort of been commercialized too, that rainbow. But seeing it in nature was powerful. And so I saw a rainbow here. And I was like, oh, we need to be here. And so we left Stoutville and just went back to New York and said, can't stay here. So we went to Honduras for 6 weeks. And that was a story within itself that I keep dear to my heart and don't ever really talk about very often, because it was just a special moment and I keep those memories close. But when we came back from the space, the island that we were staying on, Harry and I decided, it's like, let's go to Hudson. Let's move there. Let's just go. And we did. He said, I have an apartment. You want to live with me for 3 months? 6 months. It only lasted for 3 because I drove him insane. And so it lasted for 3 months. And then it became, you know, I ended up finding my own place and going from, you know, still the place that I live in now, which has been my most comfortable. But we came to Hudson and we integrated ourselves into the community. And people really, really, really took us in. You know, we met the people that, knowing that there was Black folks here who were striving and who were succeeding, and succeeding in a way, not necessarily in the traditional way of success of like, oh, they had so much money and property, but they were happy, you know, and they were hopeful and optimistic. And you need that when you're in publishing and when you're in arts and it's independent and you're constantly looking how to rob Peter to pay Paul. You know, you need that. And it's something that the city keeps you moving, but you need that respite in order to really, like, just like the other Hudson River school painters did and many artists, you know, before and after that, you need this place in order to see some things a lot more clearly. And that's what, you know, we came up here with that dream, and it was very much so realized, you know, in the issue that came out, the romanticism issue. In the cover story, we shot it at the Bronson House, which, as you know, the prison that the Bronson House is affiliated with or has a history with, was where Ella Fitzgerald, you know, the correctional facility for girls, Ella Fitzgerald was there and got her start. You know, she was introduced to singing, and are not introduced to it, but she ran away, and then she, like a year later, she was like premiering. And so we were like, wow, there's this history, there's a deep queer and African American history that is embedded within the Hudson River Valley that a lot of people don't know about, and it lives in obscurity. And it was beautiful that we were able to be a part of that movement to bring those stories to life. And I don't want to discount that there were many other people who were doing the same thing. You know, they were the library, which we're sitting in, Hudson Area Library, has been doing it. People like Elena Mosley through her African American Festival. People who, like Reginald Madison, who's an artist who, you know, was from Louisiana, his family's from Louisiana, who migrated to Chicago. He was a part of the Black Arts Movement, moved to Massachusetts, and then came to Hudson. They're all a part of that narrative. And then you have more of a contemporary movement, like the Shanikas, who came from Brooklyn, or the Shabala selves, and the Mike Mosbys, you know, from Mike grew up in the Valley, and then Shaba, who grew up in Harlem but is now here, or Jenny Jones, who's from Chicago, or Jamie Hollins, who grew up in this little town called Poplar Bluffs, Missouri, and came here, you know, who also was a reason that we felt more comfortable being here. You know, all of these people, and I can't say, you know, even folks that have a little bit of a tense relationship with Hudson kind of made us think, like, or made me think, I can only speak for myself, but, you know, Sierra Galloway is like the Wiz of Hudson. I don't know if I should say that, because the Wiz has both positive and negative things, but even love him or hate him, I was like, wow, a gay black man, owns all this property in Hudson. No one ever knew. Who would know? And not even touching on his politics or what people think about it. Just in reflecting on that alone, I was like, this place is interesting. I think when I was thinking about what I was going to talk about today, at one point, I was like, Annie, I'm not going to show up. I think it would be too difficult for me to give an interview, because I can't say that all of my memories in Hudson have been happy ones, even as they relate to the art and queer identity. You know, I have made a lot of friends here. I've lost some. I have been happy here, and I've been completely lost. You know, the reason why I came here initially, you know, I don't work with the 10th anymore. And it goes on without me, which is beautiful, because I think that's the sign of something that that's growing, and it's beautiful to be a part. Sometimes it's beautiful to be a part of something that you're not always going to be attached to. You know, you have your moment with it, and you learn from it, and you move on. But I'm super. I don't know if it's because I'm a historian or what it is, but you know, it's hard for me to process loss sometimes. And so I was like, do I really want to bring up, like, do I want to tell all the story? And it, what am I going to say? It, I want to be positive, but I also want to be brutally honest, because that's the only way I know how to age and to deal with aging and to deal with how this world is moving, is to be as honest and transparent as I completely can. And I will say that one thing about Hudson, for me, having lived in New York City, I'm grateful for this place, because as a Black gay man, as a gay man, and as an American, we live in a youth-obsessed culture. Aging, for I think for women and for gay men, has its own culture. And I think it can be, especially, I mean, I'm not a woman, but I think women get the really horrible end of the stick. If you look at like the different creative professions, like modeling, it's like once you turn 20, you're like old and get away. But, you know, being youthful and being young when you're queer, it's like there's nothing you can do that is wrong. You have the possibility of making mistakes and getting back down and sort of constantly reinventing yourself. You are the object of desire, you know. And living in a big city, I was just reflecting on this with my friend last night who lived in Los Angeles and had to move out to Florida, or chose to. I'm very grateful to have left New York City in 2017 to move here. And even if I go back in some way to the city, I feel like it saved it. I needed to come here in order to take stock of my life and also to accept the passage of time, if that makes sense. When I go back to the city and visit with some of my friends who have not moved, I can see how if they didn't have, you know, what people consider major life events like kids or a parent die or getting married, it's very easy to see time to go by really fast and not notice it. And everything around you could be changing, but you might not have changed. Or if you change, you don't even realize it. And here is something like you really do see the passage of time in a way that, I don't know if it's because time slows down when we come here, but when I go back to New York, I feel like I know that I'm a different person. I can see that old person that I left in 2017, and I'm grateful for being away from the city and being able to, it almost saved years of my life by moving here. I was moving at a super fast pace and constantly, you know, making good relationships. You know, I was very good at that, but sometimes maintaining them, it was really hard. You know, I just would, you know, you just kind of, things just, you know, you constantly are like, oh, let's meet up, let's go to dinner, let's do this. And that's all you do. You never meet up. You never go to dinner. You know, maybe you do because you have to meet up for something work related. But there were so many times where you don't really get to sit down and enjoy people anymore. I mean, it was like that when I moved to New York originally. I was always having dinner parties and inviting people over and watching television. But, people just hanging out, stopping by your house, having a glass of wine or tea. But that changed as we got older. And I was freaking out because I'm like, I'm aging. I am really aging. And I left New York when I was like 33, 34. And as much as time also has gone fast in Hudson, I still can see it. something about me like, okay, this happened and that happened and a year has passed and these weeks have passed. Even during the pandemic, there was a certain quietness that I was left to reflect being here versus being in the city. And I can't say everything is easy, but it definitely has made it a little bit easier for me to slow down. Mm. Because I wonder who I would have been if I would have stayed there. Mm. Sometimes I think, yeah, I would have been so much better off and I would have, you know, had a better apartment and it would have been easier to find clients and jobs. But in some ways I'm like, maybe I would have just like declined rapidly and I wouldn't have even known it, or I would have been, you know, eating the same unhealthy food that I had so much more access to in the city instead of, you know, being mindful about what I was putting in my body because I live around all these farms and people who are talking about food justice, even though we still do in many ways live in a food desert. Living in a food desert, I was more aware of food justice and like eating, you know, going back to my roots of family roots of eating more nutritious than I was in the city, you know? So it is something to say about aging in a rural environment versus aging in the city environment as a queer Black man. It's different. Mm. It is so different. I have never been in a long-term committed relationship. And I thought that when I moved to Hudson, I would just find like a boyfriend or a husband and everything would just work itself out. To my extreme chagrin, that did not happen. I'm not saying that it won't, but I did, I guess, learn to fall in love with the possibility of being the best self or version of me to be able to get to that point, if that makes any sense. So it's like, I'm grateful to age here. And I don't really feel like I'm aging. I feel like I'm turning into a new person. And I'm being more honest about who I am. And I needed this. And it wasn't easy. It was so freaking hard. Because being in a small town, my parents grew up in a small town. And I used to always like, why do y'all want to leave it so bad? And then they got to a point where they wanted to retire there. And then they were like, oh no, we're not doing that. And when I got here, I was like, oh, being in a small town is so great. You know, you get to know everyone. Everybody wants you to participate in stuff. And I kind of hit the ground hard. Like, I was out partying every night, getting myself involved in every extracurricular activity, wanting to be involved in like town politics and stuff. And I realized the thing about being in a small town is everyone will know your business very quickly, and your you being anonymous will go away, and anything you do, people will talk, you know? So I learned that the hard way. But now I think I've learned how to adjust to living in small town life.
It sounds like, you know, one of the parts of living in a small town is how it kind of makes more space, both in terms of time, how it changes your relationship to time, and how it also makes more space for, because of time, how it makes more space for a complex experience of life.
Like, yes.
Loss, aging, yes. Life, living, giving, taking, you know, and so I guess, and I can't believe we're near the end of the interview.
I'm sorry.
But one,
I talked about everything except for Hudson, I'm sorry.
Which is beautiful and absolutely perfect. And I think, you know, you're walking us towards this kind of a beautiful place to end, but given all of those, all of that complexity, I'm just wondering and thinking about, like, what's a budding reality of Hudson for you right now, either in your life or something that you are curious about for the future of Hudson, just something that's a bud or emerging that you might want to leave open as we close?
I think Hudson is a good place to look at to understand where our world is headed. I mean, in this small town, there's so much ethnic and religious diversity here. You know, we have our first black mayor, you know, Kamal, you know, Mayor Kamal Johnson, is, yes. You know, we have a really large Islamic community. We have, you know, we have, I think 17% of this town is African American. But you have issues like class divide and gentrification and housing insecurity and food justice and climate change, you know, all that affect this region. And even in this small town, I think it illustrates how if Hudson can be a model for how the rest of the world is, I think it shows the frustrations that everyone has here. And if we can work through it, I think there's hope, you know? Because from 2017 to today, this town has changed so much. So many people have been displaced and because they can't afford the rent or the mortgage or businesses have sold. You know, the pandemic has impacted us. The war in Gaza, between Gaza, you know, Israel, it's impacted this region. It has impacted this town. You know, queer identity and rights. There's a lot of folks that come here to deal with, you know, to get away from the transphobia in some of the larger cities, but they still face it here. I mean, politically, we live in a blue bubble, but outside in Germantown and other parts, people really are staunch Trump supporters. So I really do feel like this place is a very special place because it does have all these sort of contradictions, but also these moments where Hudson does do things right. You know, we just passed the good cause eviction, you know, bill, which I think is wonderful to protect people from getting fair leases and also for not rent hikes. You know, there is a with mental health instead of arresting people, because a lot of people come here to heal and they have mental health issues, whether it be chronic depression, bipolarism, you know, addiction and substance abuse problems. We have now this mental health court, which doesn't want to just put people into jail or prison, but wants to actually have restorative justice where the community decides, how can we help this person? How can we rehabilitate them so they don't necessarily end up in these situations? So my hope is that we can continue, we can be a model, and we can still show that people can live together, but there's space for us also to disagree. But just to do it with a sense of respect where there's no violence and there's no bloodshed and people don't go homeless doing it, or they're not ostracized and deemed as the pariah. And that does happen here, but I think people are a little bit more open to working and hearing what other people have to say. And that's my hope for it, because that's why I love living here. But I don't know where, I hope this town will air more into that direction, because it would be so sad if it just turned into some like high-priced summer colony in, you know, the valley. I don't want that to happen. And some people think that's what it will, but I believe that it won't. I think that we are a reflection of this country, that it moves back and forth. I mean, at one point this was a vice town. And then it got raided, and then it was big for its antiques, and now it's, you know, design capital, and then now it's retail stuff. But I think, could we, you know, and then at one point it was big in industry. It was had a robust working middle class. Is there some way for that flexibility to continue? That it never is exactly just one thing, but it's almost like this experimental lab of many things. That's what I hope Hudson will always be. I don't want it to be a place where we have to constantly, like as a person in the arts industry, I don't want it to be this place where it's about presentation or transaction. Like, don't come here, say, oh, this is where all the collectors live, or this is where all the blue chip artists are. Let it be a place where artists come to inspire and be really inspired and be really into their creative process. That's what I really want for this space, is for it to be a lab and continue to be a lab, and that everyone has a home here. It's not just the creatives, it's the blue collar workers, it's the people who, just people who are looking for progressive change for everyone. It would be sad, you know, sometimes I get sad when I see the different publications define this as like the chicest town in America. I'm like, what does that mean? Because I know you're leaving someone out. That's, I hope that we don't get to that point. And I think if we don't, there's an indication that maybe we can still, you know, maybe there's hope for all of us, and there's a Hudson everywhere. You know, it's Hudson is one town, but there's so many narratives similar to this. And I just hope that we kind of can be a model for all are welcome. There's room for both. There's room for many. That's kind of like my closing thought, I guess.
Thank you. What a wonderful bud to close with. And thank you so much for your generosity, James, in sharing everything. Yeah,
of course. I hope that was something. I really feel like I went all over the freaking place. I don't even know.